Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In October of 1962, America was perched on the edge of nuclear war. We call it the Cuban Missile Crisis in Cuba. It's the October Crisis. Today, we look back at the crisis and we ask the questions, how do decades of perspective help us view this time differently? Is it possible to get ourselves into a situation like this again? Are we there already? And how do we get out of it? Joining us today is Dr. Tim McEwen. He is professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor McEwen, welcome and thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
We think we know the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have it packaged into a 13-day drama. You say there's a little more to it than that. Expand our view a little bit and help us understand the fuller story.
Well, the first way in which the 13-day story doesn't really capture what happened is that the U.S. began to worry about and to plan for the possibility of Soviet missiles in Cuba as early as the spring of 1961. It was understood that after the Bay of Pigs invasion failed and the Soviets began to provide more military assistance to the Castro regime, that there was some possibility that they might install ballistic missiles there. It was viewed as not highly probable because from the American perspective, doing that would be very, very risky. And the Soviets, during the Cold War, were generally viewed as not inclined to take big risks because they typically did not do that. However, the U.S. did begin to plan for this. And by the summer of 1962, when we get into July and August, the possibility that the Soviet arms buildup would be accompanied by ballistic missiles begins to get more and more attention at the highest levels of the U.S. government. And they begin to think seriously about the military and political responses that they would have to make if missiles were discovered.
Who are, just for people who maybe don't either recollect or have forgotten, who are the major players here? So we have Fidel Castro in Cuba, President John F. Kennedy, and Khrushchev in the Soviet Union, correct? Are there others that are really important to this conversation?
Well, in terms of understanding the American response, there's a set of officials that matter. The president's brother, Robert Kennedy, is deeply involved in making policy decisions regarding Cuba. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course, are involved in the military planning. The Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, other members of the National Security Council, Executive Committee, the famous XCOM, they're all involved in making these decisions. And, of course, ultimately, it's the president's decision about what to do.
What is the impact of the Bay of Pigs invasion? Put that into a historical framework for us as far as, you know, what the Soviets feel they need to do next.
It signals to the Soviets, the way they view the Bay of Pigs is that it's an indication that the Americans are determined to remove Castro. So the Soviets think of the problem, it's funny, they think of it in exactly the same way that American national security planners of the day thought of their problems. From the Soviet standpoint, this is a problem in deterrence. How do we deter the Americans from attacking Cuba again? And Khrushchev's answer to that was, well, let's install ballistic missiles. After all, the Americans did that to us in Turkey and Italy. We can do it to them. And it's ironic that in 1959, when the Eisenhower administration went ahead with their plans to install ballistic missiles in Turkey and Italy aimed at the Soviet Union, Eisenhower said to officials of the day that he would understand why, from the Soviet standpoint, if he observed the Americans doing this, that the Soviets would be tempted to install their ballistic missiles in some place like Mexico or Cuba. Mm-hmm. And he says this, of course, well in advance of the time when the Cuban Revolution becomes openly communist and well in advance of the time when the Soviets had close relations with Castro.
So why go ahead with it then? Did Eisenhower have a, you know, he has an awareness of what dominoes could really fall. Why is it important for the United States to put ballistic missiles in Turkey in his mind?
Well, that's a really good question. And at this point, it's not entirely clear what the answer was. Those missiles were not highly accurate. They were also installed above ground, which meant they were vulnerable to a Soviet first strike. Mm-hmm. So their military value wasn't very great. One suspects that the primary reason they were installed was because they amounted to an increase in the political threat that the Soviet Union faced and were another signal that the Americans were determined to contain Soviet power. I suspect that's what ultimately drove the decision.
Let's talk about Fidel Castro at this time. What kind of leader is he in Cuba? Why is the United States government so determined to see him leave?
Castro in 1962 is still relatively popular. The bloom had not yet fallen off the rose of the revolution, so to speak. The United States government has a number of reasons why they want Castro out, having to do with the fact that he was deliberately dismissive of American preferences. He was taking Cuba down a development path that was not what the Americans wanted them to do. He was hostile to American investors. He was hostile to the U.S. government. He was looking around for support for his regime from places other than the United States. His revolution served as a beacon to other people in Latin America and Central America who were dissatisfied with their governments. And it encouraged them to begin to take action against their governments, too. So for all these reasons, the United States viewed Castro as a big headache.
Hmm. Is he unhinged? Is he a madman? Is he portrayed as a madman at the time?
Castro?
Mm-hmm.
I think the in American media, he's certainly not portrayed very favorably by this point. Coverage of Castro during the revolution in the 50s was far more ambivalent, with some people actually saying positive things about him and other people saying negative things. I don't think that American media coverage of Castro became decisively negative until he began taking actions against American property and began mass executions of Batista regime officials and that sort of thing. I think at that point, opinion in the United States turned decisively against him.
When we look back at the last, you know, more than 50 years of sort of historical scholarship and the way the story is told, you know, what do we see now in perspective that we didn't see then?
Well, I think realizing that the missiles weren't quite the surprise that they were cracked up to be is part of having a deeper understanding of it. I think it's also important to notice that the way the United States dealt with the threat was actually fairly imaginative and multifaceted. They did a lot of things other than simply build up their military and prepare to invade. For example, once the U.S. decided that it was going to challenge the missiles, the very first thing it did was, even before Kennedy made his speech, the State Department swung into action and mobilized this major diplomatic effort to contact all U.S. allies, to send personal emissaries to the British and the French and the Germans and the Canadians, the Italians, Mayor Willy Brandt of West Berlin. All of these people got a personal emissary from the United States saying, this is what's happening, this is what we're about to do, can we count on you for support? They did a similar thing with regard to all the Latin American countries. They dispatched emissaries to a number of them. The president wrote individual letters to each Latin American head of state. They did individual briefings for 95 different foreign ambassadors who were resident in Washington, D.C. So there was this extremely substantial effort to mobilize diplomatic support. It involved not only contacting these countries, but going to the Organization of American States and getting a resolution of support out of the OAS that was essentially unanimous, and going to the UN Security Council and making the case that the Soviets were committing an act of aggression. That led to one of the most famous minutes of the missile crisis, where Adlai Stevenson, the U.S. ambassador, point blank asks the Russian ambassador to the UN, are you or are you not installing offensive missiles in Cuba? And the Russian ambassador is very equivocal, and he won't answer the question, and he pretends he doesn't understand the translation. And Stevenson just keeps hammering, saying, I'm prepared to wait for your answer until hell freezes over, Mr. Ambassador. Which, of course, the American media loved. That was everyone's favorite news clip that night. But it goes to show that there was a substantial diplomatic effort that paralleled the military effort, so it wasn't simply the U.S. amassing weapons and making military threats. It was maneuvering to basically isolate the Soviets and to mobilize a lot of third-party support for what the U.S. was doing.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis with Professor Tim McEwen. He is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And I think this is something that everybody, thinks about when they think about this time in history, and they just say, how close did we come? Based on your research, how close did we come to a really all-out use of nuclear weapons?
I think we came very, very close, and I say that for two reasons. The first is that there were a number of incidents during the crisis where U.S. or Soviet forces actually fired on one another. U.S. ships depth-charged Soviet submarines in the Atlantic on a couple of occasions. The Soviets shot down a U-2 flying reconnaissance over Cuba. Another American U-2 accidentally strayed into Soviet airspace on an air sampling mission along the Siberian coast of the USSR, and that led to Soviet fighters being scrambled to intercept the U-2. And a very anxious few moments while the U-2 pilot hastily recognized his error and quickly changes course and heads for Alaska while Soviet interceptors are climbing and trying to catch up to him. And U.S. interceptors are being scrambled to provide protection for him. If the timing had been a little different, the Soviet interceptors and the American interceptors and the U-2 all would have been in the same airspace at the same time, and who knows what would have happened then. So there were these incidents in which control of the armed forces on both sides was not perfect. The other reason that we came very close to war was that by near the end of the crisis, on the last Saturday of the crisis, the XCOM has a meeting to decide what to do now that the Soviets have been notified that the Americans want them to withdraw the missiles, and the Soviets have refused to withdraw them. So what happens next? At that Saturday meeting, there was a long and very difficult discussion that basically broke down into two sides. On one side, there were the advisors who decided or thought that the best thing to do was to go ahead with the airstrikes followed by an invasion of Cuba. On the other side, there was one person. That person was John Kennedy. And he said, no, this is not yet the time to do that. We need to give the negotiation process more time. I think he was aware when he said that his brother was going to be meeting with the Soviet ambassador privately to work out a deal. So he had some reason to think that perhaps a better result could be obtained. But if Robert Kennedy had not succeeded in working out a deal, and if Khrushchev had not announced on Sunday that he was withdrawing the missiles, then the president's schedule had him in a Monday morning NSC meeting where the only item on the agenda was to approve the airstrike and invasion plans. So at that point, had the other events not intervened, the U.S. probably would have decided to go ahead and use force, and that would almost certainly have led to a war between the Soviet Union and the United States.
Let's finish with some lessons for today, and let's start with who the president is really matters, you've written.
I think it does. I think John Kennedy had combat experience, and it led him to a certain, shall we say, healthy skepticism about the plans of higher-level officers. And particularly after the Bay of Pigs, he never took military vice at face value. He also had the self-confidence to basically stand in front of his entire National Security Council and say, you guys are wrong. You're not looking at this the right way. You're being too parochial. And not a lot of presidents would do that. That is an exceptional thing. And it's very fortunate that he did have the self-confidence to do that, because history shows that he did make the right call.
Do you see other lessons for today? If President Trump called you and asked you for advice on the situation with North Korea, and you had a chance to sit down and talk with him in the Oval Office about history and how it impacts decisions in 2017, what direction would you lead?
Well, I guess the first thing I would tell him would be to go back and look at the history of U.S. conversations with North Korea about this very question. There's nothing about what the North Koreans are doing that is at all surprising, and in that regard, it is different from Cuba. They've been working on a nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program since the early 90s. We almost went to war with them in 1994 in the Clinton years. And what we got instead was a negotiated agreement with the North Koreans that they would basically freeze their weapon system development in exchange for which we would replace their nuclear infrastructure with light water power reactors that would not be capable of generating weapons-grade material. We would provide them with fuel oil to basically fill in the energy cap while their light water reactors are being built, and that we would begin to normalize relations with North Korea. I would tell Donald Trump to look at why that agreement fell apart. There were problems on both sides. The North Koreans didn't live up to their commitments, but unfortunately the United States didn't live up to its commitments either. And I would basically say, go back to that agreement and look at what aspects of it would seem to work now and try to build on those. I think the notion that the situation can be solved by simply increasing coercive pressure on the North is not likely to work. This is a regime that can tolerate mass famine in its population for years and not flinch. And this is a regime where most of the population seems to be behind the regime on this question of nuclear weapons. So I think the odds that the U.S. can simply coerce them into a surrender is not very high.
Tim McEwen is with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Have a good day.